Hello, I'm Zev Neuwirth, and welcome to our newly rebranded Creating a New Healthcare podcast. This is a podcast series for folks who are interested in positive perspectives and successful approaches to advancing health and healthcare. In this podcast, we are going to introduce you to bold, courageous leaders and visionary entrepreneurs, rebel leaders who are in fact transforming and humanizing healthcare. This podcast is for you if you want to hear and contribute to a generative, inclusive, and positive counter-narrative in our healthcare system. It's for you if you want to be a leader in your own health and healthcare. Folks, a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my contemporaries are pretty jaded and pessimistic about the outlook and the future of healthcare delivery, particularly in this country. But I can honestly say that I don't see the future that way. I am really positive. And one of the reasons is that we have a whole new generation, or perhaps even generations, of emerging leaders. And what I think of as a new and emerging leadership mindset that is different than the past. And it really gives me tremendous hope for the immediate future of healthcare delivery. And so I am super interested in understanding it and appreciating it and sharing it. And that's what we're going to be doing today with our guest, who is Brian Urban. So Brian, let me just introduce you and just welcome to the show.
Thank you, Zev. It's a true honor to add to the, well over 300 podcasts I think you've done, and I love the setup. You've definitely made my day.
Well, it's so good to hear your voice again. Brian, why don't we start, and I have so many questions I want to ask you, but you have an interesting background, and I'm just wondering if you could just lay out sort of your kind of where you came from and your education and your career path and your continuing education, which I think is really cool too. So, and I'll riff off of that and then start diving into some of the other questions.
Yeah, a perfect way to get deeper in the conversations of. So my background is a bit obscure. It's definitely not a vertical path that a lot of people take inside the healthcare ecosystem. And I started my career on the health plan side. I worked for Highmark for a number of years, with Cigna for almost 8 years, and Walgreens specialty drug side and the rare and orphan disease, standing up analytic engines focused on social determinants of health. And my path went that way because I truly didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I've never fit the standard cut of a healthcare business person or a health and wellness leader or a tech leader. I've done a bunch of things, and I've led a lot of lives in healthcare, and my education is kind of part of that too. I'm on my funny to say it, I'm on my fourth master's degree that's coming with a PhD as well. And I love to learn, not intending to say that in a braggadocious way. I have an obsession with learning and connecting into groups that I think need to be put together in a community that can push healthcare forward. And what I'm currently at Brown University right now, and that's my academic kind of research world. But I'm also with FinThrive, and I'm an innovation director, and I face our emerging markets, which is everything from health plans to life science to device and tech companies, and really just hoping to make a big impact in terms of improving health equity programs and how data is core to the next generation of public health innovators.
So I have to ask a couple of questions. One is, what master's do you already have, and what is the master/PhD that you're currently working on?
It's kind of funny. I've never liked education, at least the construct that exists within the U.S. Growing up, I just as a context here, did not like going to a full-time job in high school or in middle school, that you're there for 8 hours a day. And it's a lot of content that I didn't appreciate or didn't find interest in. So whenever I went through undergrad and then graduate degree, I really started to get into more of the personalized education experience. And I realized I love so many different things that aren't necessarily history or the English literature or world cultures. I just like different components of the healthcare ecosystem. So my first master's degree was in exercise physiology and corporate wellness promotion. So I actually was a physical trainer for a long time and health coach for health plans. And then I realized, hey, I need to have more of a business acumen. And I got another advanced degree as an MBA, a small private Christian university in Pennsylvania. And then after that, I was like, you know what? I feel like I need to have more of a public health sense to business. So why not go back for school again? I got a master's of public health from Dartmouth. And then now I'm in a technology leadership program at Brown. And similar to Dartmouth, it's a hybrid program. You go there once a quarter. So you have in-person time with your cohort and faculty and other guest lecturers. And you can really have more of a speed to impact with what you're doing rather than researching in a lab and going through a dissertation for 4 years and not seeing the application into industry. I think the program at Brown defies a lot of the constructs that other organizations in academia offer today. So I'm just really fortunate to be a part of it.
That's great. A technology leadership. That's interesting. So is that focused more on the sort of leadership and technology or the, yeah, kind of curious.
And I'm just getting into it, so I'm on the early road of this adventure. But a lot of it goes around the enterprise view of technology at different parts for me, of healthcare, where I'm most interested. But there's a lot of great folks that come from a military background, that come from communications, that come from cybersecurity. So it's having a nice purview
That's
to
great.
things that I don't really know, and mixing in my own perspectives as well. And I'm very thankful to actually be studying, as a part of my early work here, the Data Humanity Lab, which I'm thankful to have stood up with FinThrive and with TransUnion Healthcare. And it's just another level of where I think the industry needs to go with data exchange.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about that Data Humanity Lab. That's a really, really interesting name. But before that, tell me a little about FinThrive. So, what does FinThrive do, and what do you do in FinThrive?
FinThrive is a young brand. We're about 2 years old with the name FinThrive. We are the combination of three organizations: our legacy brand, which is nThrive, formerly MedAssets. We're built on a huge revenue management technology stack that spans over 3,000 contracts we have in US healthcare. And there's two other acquisitions that made us FinThrive today. One is an acquisition through exclusive rights to TransUnion Healthcare. So that's the socioeconomic data and contact information data side of that major credit bureau. And then the other acquisition was Pelotas, a patient portal access platform out of Dallas, Texas. So these three companies combined, nThrive, TransUnion Healthcare, and Pelotas, make FinThrive. So we have a really big end-to-end play across the ecosystem. And my role is an innovation director and leading our emerging markets go-to-market strategies. So as a part of the innovation side of my role, I work cross-functionally a lot with our marketing performance teams, our product teams, and our sales teams to develop unique product bundles and a lot of really rich content that shows who we are, not only as leaders, but also as philanthropic innovators. And that's a large part of that Data Humanity Lab. In the emerging markets, is purely all the segments that we face to develop new business and partnerships across life science, device, clinical research organizations, health plans, healthcare as well.
So give me an example of a, you just talked about product bundles. Give me an example of like who a customer would be and what problem you're helping them solve.
A lot of what my focus, and I just truly from a passion perspective as well, is with our socioeconomic data sets. And our attribute data, we can call it in this bucket, is all the adverse life events that a credit bureau can see quite literally in real time pulling from public available resources, but also acquiring data and maintaining it really well. And I think that's really what's special about TransUnion is they continually maintain data. They don't just sit back and source it from legacy sources that they've pulled from. They try and get better and have higher accuracy of what we call fill rates. So this is everything from liens, judgments, criminal activity, who's passed away in the home, preferred language, race, ethnicity, contact information, down to is it a paid by minute phone or voice over internet? And when you look at health plans in particular, one of the biggest just miscues, not only just for health plans, but also for government bodies as well at the state level, has been with Medicaid redetermination, the unwinding of a public health emergency, re-enrollment in Medicaid. That hasn't happened since pre-pandemic. And it's an eligibility issue. It is a contact issue. And we had tens of millions of people fall off Medicaid and have gaps in their healthcare coverage and even more distrust with healthcare and health plans than ever before. And it's all due to admin errors. So when we think about cleaning up data, it's having the right contact information and how people prefer to be contacted in the first place. And then what language? That really shows for a health plan, you're fulfilling the missions you've always had. And it's cleaning up your data. And then the other side of it is, in terms of just a health plan perspective, let alone the other players we work with, is if you're knowing what challenges are present in someone's life, you don't need to screen and script an SDOH screening survey. Right. It's great that NCQA has developed it, the baby right. steps. We need to take big leaps if we're really going to care about people in authentic mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. And it's just about validating their needs and letting them know, like, hey, we're here to help you. And what services might you be interested in? Whether it's a food, transportation, payment assistance, housing, those are critical basic needs that health plans now are starting to be held accountable if we look out to 25, 26 and beyond. And their data as a foundation, pointing them in what direction they need to best serve their members is critical. So that's a lot of where my attention is on a literally day-to-day basis.
What I really love about what you're saying is that sort of real-time transactions that occur that can tell you, hey, this person is in trouble, or this person is heading towards trouble, or this is a vulnerable individual or family. And that's very, like you say, that's a much, much more precise real-time indicator than, you know, these SDOH questionnaires, which are, I think, to your point, I just think there's going to be a lot of challenge in implementing them. And the other part of it too, I think was where you were going, is the actionability of it. So let's say you do discover it, and maybe you don't get into this part of it, but when you inform or you provide the data and the information that, hey, this is a set of people who have these specific issues, how does that translate into actually doing something about it? And, you know, I do have to sort of wonder and ask without being too jaded, but can this be used against the individuals or, you know, when you're talking about insurance companies? So again, just kind of a couple of questions about it.
Yeah, these are very valid questions for a lot of folks that aren't in this very finite space that I'm thankful to be in. So I will say overall, the application of the data can be quite complex. And for health plans in particular, I'll touch on them and then healthcare, the use cases are across the board. Across populations and across business lines, whether you're talking Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, commercial, or anything in between, DSNP, et cetera. And to find the right use case and then ROI is a very complicated thing for newer CFOs to the space, necessarily, not by title, but by just experience. So it has to connect to, we have this data, but then how are we actually helping a person downstream? What is the workflow? Does it actually go to a program? And a lot of people say closed loop referral. It's a very common term. It's funny because you don't want, it can't be a noun. You helped a person do a thing at a point in time. It has to be a continual flow and follow through of help. So closed loop referral is kind of a falsehood. And it's fine to check boxes in terms of getting points, maybe if you think about it that way from an experience perspective or CAP surveys, things like that. But there should be no closing of a, of a service. It should be a continued follow through someone's life and health journey because they're interconnected. But health plans are really struggling to understand, how do we put this into existing workflows that connect to existing programs that have an output of controlling population spend and that improve experience and engagement with us as a trusted entity, as a part of this person's life, as members experience with us. So that is a challenge. A lot of our work falls into Medicare Advantage and Medicaid managed care organizations because they're more of high social needs. Some of them are obviously older or have physical or cognitive disabilities. So there's a lot of interconnectedness between our data and the application and the output. And for healthcare, the biggest challenge we're seeing right now is, so a physician is in front of a patient, they're not maybe trained by background in terms of social health questionnaires. So you give them a laundry list of data and you validate, hey, they're not going to be able to pay for their care today. They're probably not going to be able to eat today or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. How do we refer them to something? Mm-hmm. That's not an infrastructure that's built today. And the challenge with both of those sides is working through an intervention strategy and a data application as well. And the point behind the Data Humanity Lab is to develop a lot of these use cases at no risk from a cost perspective to health plans, research entities, and healthcare organizations. And it will develop a lot of use cases that can be replicated across the market. And we hope that a lot of other organizations that are competitors or that are our partners contribute in the same right and give data, give service, give their labor at no cost to actually start to advance things in the healthcare economy.
Yeah, that was great in terms of, I think, painting that picture and some of the challenges in terms of making things actionable. And I really like that sort of notion. I had not heard of this closed loop referrals, but it gets a sense of,
yeah.
By closed loop, it means checking a box. And as you're pointing out, that probably isn't the appropriate way to go. It does check a box and it may get you the score you need, but in terms of actually a high impact social health program, it sounds to me like that's not what you think is the right way to go.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting,
yeah.
Zev, because
yeah.
When I was at the tail end of my experience with Walgreens, I had the opportunity to assess data aggregators, raw data suppliers, and social health platform vendors as well. And a lot of those vendors use the terminology of closed loop referral. Mm. And they're like social safety, kind of social healthcare network structures. And that's great, but it just, from my perspective, being in the house of tech and then being in the academic research world is, let's get our words right. And let's get the programs structured around what we really intend to do with some of these programs. And it can't be a point in time. Mm-hmm. And it can't be just checking these boxes off. And actually, one thing mm-hmm. you'd asked me before I didn't mm-hmm. address of is mm-hmm. kind of permissible use. So mm-hmm. with any raw data supplier that is of a credit bureau nature,
yeah.
major or small, you're within the confines of the federal government from what's called a Graham-Leach-Biley Act, which is a permissible use act. So you cannot have data used to solicit unnecessary services or something that could do someone harm. And there's a lot of use case analysis that goes in the work we do with TransUnion to our partners. So if it doesn't align that it's actually going to benefit an individual, it could produce harmful outcomes, unintended, unconscious or conscious, then we can't go forward with that. So there is a lot of regulation that's put into place, rightfully so. And obviously we have to abide by that. So it's kind of a foundational, what's on the playing field, kind of our inbounds, out of bounds application with data.
Mm-hmm. So the Data Humanity Lab, I love that name, the Data Humanity
yeah.
Lab. So what do you do in that lab?
This is a really cool thing. I've always wanted to do this type of thing, Zev. So the Data Humanity Lab is a learning lab, but it's also a marketplace influencer, in which you can consider this a friendly punch to the face of the rest of the industry. I'll say it in a good way. So one is it's our radical contribution. So we have this type of data, exclusive access to this data, and it shows so much about an individual. If we can see that, we are also responsible to help people because we know this information. And it can't be next to a dollar sign. So if I think there's a lot of players out there that have health equity they're pushing, but they have a hard dollar sign right next to it. The Data Humanity Lab does not. So in order for us to radically improve how we're seeing a whole person, we have to give this data away for no cost. And we also have to give our services and labor with it. So it's myself as a researcher, it's our data modelers and engineering team and experts that have been a part of this data set for over 20 years that come with these donations. And we're giving it away for two parts. One, to advance existing health equity programs that could be across the spectrum of interventions, and whether it's food, transportation, payment, access. And then the other side of it is to help researchers. There's a lot of great institutions that have access to dollars to spend, and they usually spend it on claims data. And it's been done for decades. A lot of the schools I've went to, a lot of the school I'm at right now, they'll go to the CDC, they'll go to CMS, and they'll buy claims data, de-identified. That's great. It shows what's happening in the four walls, point of service. There's no reflection on that person as a human, not a patient or a member, just as a human being. And we need to change that script. So one of our big donations is to Dartmouth College, and they're working with a philanthropic innovator to look at medical debt and debt at the household level, and how if you alleviate those debt, what does it change in terms of their healthcare journeys? The other one we're going to be announcing is UPMC on their Medicaid side, looking at a very impoverished area in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania. And the last one is Christus Health in Texas, looking at how do we standardize and recreate charity care and payment assistance by going way upstream and not only helping people pay for their care to improve the trust they have in healthcare again, but what are the things that are affecting why they can't pay for care? And how can we start to address that? Not just through the clinicians they're seeing, but through other networks and anchor systems that are in the community that can help them be able to have a better quality of life and know that they need to go to healthcare, not with exacerbated conditions, but before things start, or how to better manage their care as they might have conditions at the moment. So it's a radical contribution in terms of giving, labor, data, but also a learning lab so we can replicate these use cases and share them. Because I think if anyone has the visibility of this kind of data, they have to give it out in terms of contributions or add something back into the economy. We can't have health equity with a dollar sign next to it, or else we'll never actually advance health equity.
Yeah. Again, I think as I listen to you, I think a couple of thoughts. One is there's a lot of opinion and beliefs and biases around all of this that you're talking about in terms of poverty and medical debt and other debt and kind of socioeconomic factors. And what I think is really, really critically important about the work you're doing is it's bringing a more objective, data-backed understanding of what is the situation and what are the correlations, what makes things worse, what makes things better. And so I think that sort of data-backed understanding is so, so important, because this could become easily a matter of opinion and belief and also even politicized, and
oh, yeah.
You know, that would be tragic. And so I think that objectivity is really, really important. I'm taking that sort of data and science-backed perspective. And then the other thing I think as I listen to you is just, again, this notion of it's not just the understanding, but asking the question, so what does this understanding lead us to do? And then as we do those things, is it actually improving the outcomes, and in what ways? What can we learn from that? So it's laborious, but I think it seems to me this moves a lot faster, can move a lot faster, because it is collecting real-time data. And I suspect you can do experiments much faster than sort of multi-year, large-scale clinical interventions or payment interventions. I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts about how much time this will take and how much effort.
Yeah, I think it's no lie that this is going to take a lot of sweat and equity into these projects that I just listed. So most of them are in the confines of a 12-month view. Some of them do go into an 18 month view and possibly a 24 month view in terms of a timeline of doing the work until we get to an output. The best thing with this type of humanity lab is we can glean preliminary insights. So we don't have to have a final, beautiful, polished product to take into publication or take into journals or press. As we find things of note that are valuable insights that we can pass on that doesn't have cost implications to the rest of the marketplace, we can share this quickly. And it's all in good nature to say, hey, these are the things that we're finding. Everybody, in terms like of an open source of information, you can use us to help build your own advances in data strategy for addressing health equity and programmatic development as well. And as we continue with this, we're accepting more partners looking into 25 and 26. So it's not just like a one-time project. This is a sustainable project initiative that we're getting into with the Data Humanity Lab. And we're hoping that, you know, during this time frame, we influence others, like I mentioned before, to make a contribution to the healthcare economy as well and research community. So it's not just us, and we don't want to, you know, brag about that, but we want to make sure others that we're all on the same team. You know, everyone can make money. There's not a problem. No matter what, everyone will make their money. It's okay. But if you don't start actually putting application to these ideas, then it's going to take forever. So that's kind of our big cry out for everybody else is, hey, do your part too.
Yeah. And you mentioned UPMC and Christus and Dartmouth. And I have to imagine you'd be wanting to, and the CMS and state governments as well would be interested in this data and participating as well. And I'm just thinking, you know, all the healthcare economists and policymakers, are you interacting with those folks as well?
Not yet. We are going to be talking about these partnerships that are just coming into announcement. I'm a little ahead of kind of sharing that, but
okay.
You know, it's going to be, we think, influential for CMS, for NCQA as a, mm-hmm. you know, a front pocket to CMS to say, hey, we need to have a more thoughtful data strategy, and doing these little steps to get to where we ultimately need to go. I think we need to speed that up a little bit.
Yeah.
Not everyone needs handholding across our healthcare ecosystem. These are large organizations with a lot of free cash, and on the health plan side, at least, that mm-hmm. need to invest wisely, and doing mm-hmm. it before regulations are put in place is what we hope mm-hmm. to showcase of like, hey, here's where you need to go.
Yeah.
It'd be great if you come with us, but you can go with someone else too, as long as you make that progress.
Right.
We're not there yet, but I would love to be able to work with a lot of government agencies because they too have been stuck in a, you know, claims, clinical encounter, health outcomes specific realm. And I mean, it's a big world of data, but also there's a lot of small data that we can intricately put in place to.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, we need more young people going into data science.
Oh yeah.
Right. I mean, it's now, you know, when I think about the education system and the STEM programs, we desperately, desperately need more folks who are expert in this. Let me jump to another question I had. You know, in our correspondence, you wrote about this, and I quote you, the next generation in public health and what that will require of practitioners entering the field. Again, unquote, speaking of the next generation of folks going into healthcare. So what is the next generation in public health, and what will it require of folks going into the field?
I love this question, Zev. So, at my time at Dartmouth in their program of clinical policy and health practice and their public health program, I was very much an outlier. I was not in healthcare law. I was not a nurse, not an MD, not a PA, nothing in the clinical world. I was someone that had more of a product development, go-to-market marketing person that loved socioeconomic data. I was such an oddball in this cohort of 40 people. And throughout my kind of experience and listening to all these folks, there's a huge gap in public health education, undergrad and graduate. And that is, there's a disconnect between understanding the business model that exists in the US healthcare ecosystem today that's driven a lot by health plans in terms of their contracting methodologies, their M&A activity. That's just not connected in public health. And the other side of it is public health traditionally looking at disease causal pathways, epidemiology, virology, those are great foundational things that affect how we live in our societies in a healthy way from a disease standpoint. But if we're actually going to look in the next generation, we have to move beyond that foundation that's been around for a long time and go into these other obscure areas of how does the healthcare ecosystem use alternative data sets that aren't clinical, that aren't disease oriented, that are whole person. So that next generation public health athlete, I try to say all the time, needs to have a very good understanding of what's happening outside of clinical practice and policy that influences those worlds. And a lot of it is the tech side, the data exchange side from a raw data or modeling standpoint. So there needs to be a heavy tech and business component. You're seeing a lot of MBA and PhD programs come up, which is great. I think that's one step in the right direction. But the curriculum needs to be advanced at hyperspeed if we're going to have the next generation of public health players really make an impact that isn't just siloed in one space. And there still is going to be a lot of like really great hyper disciplines and a lot of the foundational things public health represents. But if we want to be able to have people that can play a lot of different positions and make an impact faster, they got to know a lot more about the ecosystem and what's pushing on it in terms of different data.
Wow, you sort of are blowing my mind here, and it follows from everything you've said so far. But yeah, it seems like you're right. You call it like the public health athlete, the public health expert, the public health, you know, activist. This is going to be, you're right, it's not just the traditional epidemiology, disease monitoring. It really is, since we know that the majority of healthcare is not clinical, the impact on health and health outcomes are not clinical, but socioeconomic. And we really have to have this sort of divergence and bringing in all these other factors and bringing all that data together. And I would argue even behavioral data, you know, we can see that online, that digital twin we all have, right? It is what it is. I mean, whether we're shopping or scrolling on social media, it's all there and it reflects our behavior and our behavior patterns and our likes and our dislikes and our needs and our disabilities. And so I have to say what you're saying makes me think about, this is almost like the inverse of the social dilemma. This is, for those of you who haven't seen that documentary, which I would highly recommend, it's a little frightening, but it's a documentary about all the different social channels we have and online channels, and whether it's Facebook and Twitter and others, and how they've been using the available data. And I'm curious what you think about this, Brian, but I mean, their sophistication, talk about the greatest data geeks coming out of the greatest schools in the world. Yeah. This is where they go, right?
Yeah.
And this is where they go to work. And all of that data has been used. I mean, what's really interesting is if you're not paying for the product, this was a quote I got from that documentary. If you're not paying for the product, then you are the product. Isn't that a great quote? And what they were saying in that, and these were all the people who were the giants who started all of these social channels and now are sort of looking back and saying, wow, I didn't know this is what was going to happen. And this is the harm we would be causing folks and how we would be using folks. But it's not just that you're the product, but the idea is your behavior is the product. Yeah. And they're manipulating your behavior actively, automatically, with state-of-the-art digital and all of the information, by the way, Brian, you've been talking about. And what I hear you say is, let's bring all of that state-of-the-art, cutting-edge digital technology and data analytics and bringing all of the different sources of information together, but let's do it to actually help people, particularly around the social determinants of health, which again, we know determine most of our health outcomes, not the clinical stuff. And so I see what you're saying. What's exciting for me, and so what's hopeful and positive, is that we've now used that data for, one could argue, for harm and for making some people really wealthy and selling products. Could we now, and by the way, you know, core to all of that, of course, is behavior change. And what most people don't realize is the folks who built these social channels, they all went to the same school. They all learned how to manipulate behavior from BJ Fogg, Professor Fogg at Stanford, whom, As it turns out, I've spent a few days with in person learning at his side, and many, many months, if not years, actually speaking to him. He's amazing. But what he taught was this interface of how do you use technology to manipulate behavior. And it was so far ahead of its time and so brilliant. But what these folks did with it and what these organizations continue to do with it is basically use it to manipulate behavior so people purchase things and whatnot. But what I see is, and I apologize for going on, but what I see is you actually taking us out of those that dark age, that that dystopian future that we could be heading towards. And what's exciting for me, and it goes back to exactly what I said when we started talking, what excites me is this new leadership mindset, this new generation of young and emerging leaders like yourself. And there's so many of you out there. And I'm just like, oh, wow, thank God. I think what you said is important about your background. I just want to say something. You are a divergent, right? You are, right? And listen, I'm a divergent too, and it makes me feel good to meet divergence. In fact, you mentioned before I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people over the past decade. I would say the vast majority are divergents. They're people like you who have pulled in, come from different perspectives and are seeing the world differently. And it's just you're not like you said, I forget how you said it, but you didn't fit the standard cut. That's what you said. And
I don't,
yeah, I think that humanistic foundation that you have and is so evident in so many others that I've been talking to, and then taking it and then, four masters and a PhD and all the experience you have, and saying, I'm going to do this for the good of humanity and I'm going to see it through. And I'm reaching out to others. I find that to me, we need to make a new documentary. I don't know what it's called, but it's the opposite of the social dilemma. And if you want to go there with me, I've got some others who we could bring along.
Oh, I do want to go there with you, Zeb. And like, oh man, what a just dream I'm in at the moment to be hearing you say these things. Honestly, I've been just an oddball for such a long time because my ideas didn't fit the typical business model of like, hey, make more money, make more money. I think it's just so played out now that we're using consumer marketing data, behavior data to continually blind our fellow people in society and get them to do the things that we want them to do, whether it's obviously voting or if it's purchasing. Yeah, I don't think it's still too far out of reach that we're going to have AI commerce that, Amazon or other big organizations are just going to send you things that are the highest likelihood that you're going to purchase, and then it's up to you to return it. And if not, it's hitting your tab. I think we're close to that, and they'll build a loving experience around it somehow, so you don't feel like you're, a prey, but it's predatory. I mean, the data has been used that way, but we're at like a collapsing point. Like, if we don't actually do something that's going to produce something good, then what's the point? Whose team are we on? It just doesn't make any sense to me. So I would love to see how competitive every organization could be, at least in my world in healthcare, on how much they give. Like, let's see who can puff their chest out on how much good they've done and giving they've done without really having a direct profit margin. I think Patagonia is a really good example of what they've done in the clothing industry of saying, hey, then literally people have bought more and they've tried to not make more and saying, yeah, we don't want to make anymore. And they have a very strong stance and morals that they believe in. And I think we need that in healthcare. And I think there's just so much conflict politically, payers, plans, and then consolidation all over the place. But we need this more now than ever. Let's see how competitive we can be in goodness and giving. Like, let's see who the best, person is, organization is that can do this rather than being flashy and heavy profit margins. Like, we'll always exist as businesses. Everyone's going to make their money. But if you don't do good things, then it's going to be more of a stagnant model in my mind, not only economically, but just societal, overall.
I love that what you just said. Let's see how competitive we can be in goodness. What a great, great quote. Let's see how competitive we could be in goodness. just want to give that a moment to sink in. I think that, you know, the hopeful thing is you're an oddball and I'm an oddball. Yeah, no, you are. And I'm an oddball.
I love your oddballness too. It's the best. I want to grow up to have your oddballness. I'll tell you in my career.
So. Well, I want to be rebirthed with your oddballness. God, if I had your technical background, God knows what I could do, but or what I'd be doing. I'd be creating the next social health media platform and doing exactly what you just said. That would be my mission, is let's see how competitive we could be in goodness. And so instead of, like you said, you know, predatory and just selling things, it's like, no, you need this to be healthy. This would help you be healthy today. And so I know we have to bring this to a close, but I think that the hopeful thing about this is it's not just you and not just me. There really are other oddballs out there. And in fact, there are movements of oddballs out there. And I think I've been actually researching this a bit and beginning to do more of it. And there are things like conscious capitalism that's out there and notions of other things that are similar to that. And I think you mentioned Patagonia as one example of a specific company, I think, that is trying to do and has been doing good and doing well financially. So it's really hopeful. I think it's bringing these tributaries together, bringing these little streams together to create a mighty river of positive change in healthcare and health in our country and across the globe. I want to give you the sort of last word. What kind of last thoughts do you have? And you don't have to, because I think you dropped the mic with what you said about competing for goodness.
Zev, thanks for just giving me this platform and the relationship we have. I love it, and I'm excited for what we'll do maybe in the future. And in terms of a last word, aside from just being so thankful, I think to everyone out there in healthcare, whether you're delivering it, you're providing coverage as insurance, bridger in technology to address different social health interventions or whatever, I think building the business model to make money obviously is a foundation, but you will not have a long-term true impact if you don't have the model of what is philanthropic innovation into the lives I serve. And that has to be pure giving. That alone, in terms of brand equity and the trust as currency, is almost immeasurable. So that, if you lead with that, honestly, just try it. It will work for you. If you don't, we're doing the same damn thing that we've done for decades. And that's going to break. It's going to break at one point, not only communities, households, but systems. So let's start just flipping the script. Just try it. And you know what? If you want help with that, I'm here too. And I come with a great community of oddballs that can help.
You know, what I said at the beginning about a new generation of leaders and a new, more importantly than that, a new leadership mindset. I think you really, again, just captured it in your last few statements. And I'm just so grateful for you for having that and holding that and living it and developing it, and super excited about what you're going to be doing in the future and where you're going to be going and who you're going to be doing that with. I hope to be part of that with you. How do people get in touch with you, Brian, if someone is interested in learning more?
Yeah, I'll say easiest way is always LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn and messaging. My email, I believe, is public as well, brian.urban@finthrive.com. I'm very responsive. So that's probably the fastest way to get a hold of me. And I am an open book and always willing to help anyone that wants to contribute toward the things we're trying to make better.
That's great. Thank you so much, Brian. I'm so psyched, and you've really made my day.
Oh, likewise.
Yeah, no. And so just want to thank you, Brian Urban from FinThrive, and you're from so many different places, for taking the time to be with us today. And as I do every episode, I'd like to conclude by thanking all of you out there who are doing the hard work each and every day of taking care of patients, and those of you who are supporting those who are directly taking care of patients. We truly appreciate you for what you do, and recognize how critically important your work is for individuals, families, communities, and our society. My friends, this is Zev Neuwirth on Creating a New Healthcare. Until next time, be well.